We're going to start with the broadest possible lens to look at the Old Testament narrative. Not just a book of the Old Testament, but the entirety of the Old Testament as a narrative. And we're going to investigate that tonight. So that's overview. Then next week we're going to come together and we're going to look at what I'm trying to do with these worksheets is kind of make them intuitive. And so there are three things that we're always going to be looking at: structure, content, and application. And we're going to, and by structure I'm using kind of the metaphor of a skeleton. A skeleton is what gives a body its form, right? That's why you're not just a blob of mass on the floor. It's because you've got a skeleton. And so you take definite shape. And a work of literature, including the Bible, has a certain very specific kind of structure, a logic, a relationship of the ideas to one another. That is really the most important part of interpretation, is to get the logic of the text down. So we're going to spend a good deal of time talking about the structure of narrative in three senses: in its setting, which as a historical narrative, the historical context matters. We're going to ask questions about who is involved, where the action takes place, and when. And then we're going to talk about what makes narrative super interesting, which is plot and dialogue. You know, the Old Testament's awesome because it's a story. It's a true story, but it's a story nonetheless. It's full of all kinds of drama. And we're going to ask the question about from the narrator's point of view, because narration is, you know, it's an art. It's someone telling you a story. And so we're going to get in there and we're going to ask, how is the story told? What is the point of view of the author? And how can we understand the author's point of view, what he's trying to get across to us? And there are techniques for that. We're going to ask the why questions. Why the actions in the story and the people matter. And then we're going to ask the what is it really all about, which is the purpose clues. And we're going to be able to see within the text of Scripture the clues that the author gives to what is the intended purpose, what is the reason for why this story is being told. And all of these things in structure, we're going to be able to glean right out of the text itself. And then we're going to go in week three, and we're going to talk about content, which is what we're calling here the muscle. It's what gives it its strength, its girth, its weight, and you know the weightiness of Scripture and what it's about. In its historic context, and then the deep theology embedded in these narratives. We're going to learn what does it look like to extract out the theological dimensions of these historical narratives. And then lastly, we want to ask the question that which the biblical authors are also asking, which is, okay, here is how God has communicated. Here's what it says about Him. Now, what does that look like in my life? And that's, you know, we'll use here the metaphor of skin. It's beauty skin deep. what do you look like? Well, you can't see past the skin, and that's what it's about. So we're asking the question, what does this passage look like? What does this narrative look like in practice? And we're going to learn what does it mean then to take application out of the passage. So that's where we're going. Tonight, we're basically not going to get any further than overview, because I want to make this a very important point that theological narrative is the main literary form of the Old Testament, and it has enormous influence also on the New Testament. Narrative in Scripture, that's the first point in your outline. Narratives are stories that are told by a narrator, and which includes substantial elements of dialogue, conversation. And so the historic section of the Old Testament, Genesis through Esther, is all historic narrative with pieces of poetry and law thrown in. But mostly it's narrative. Significant parts of the writings of the prophets are also narrative. And then when you come to the New Testament, of course, the Gospels and the book of Acts contain significant elements of narrative as well. And so all told, it's really just in terms of sheer size, narrative is the main literary form of the Bible. And I want to make the important point here that we need to start with this very broad lens, because looking at biblical narrative is kind of like looking at a multi-act play. And if you've ever come into a play or walked into a movie or whatever and it's halfway over, it's easy to get caught up in the action, but you're always asking yourself, why does this happen? And what does it mean? And you can only understand a particular scene in a movie or an act in a play in relation to the total story, right? So what we want to do tonight is we want to get an understanding of what is that total story. How would we know if the Old Testament in particular is one story? In other words, we're going to try to defend the unity of biblical narrative tonight, because that is a fundamental need if we are going to interpret Scripture. If all we have is cubism, right? You know, in painting where you just got, you know, this cube and that cube, and you got a woman who's got a mouth over here and eyes over here and a butt hanging out over there, that doesn't really hold together very well. It's not symmetrical. It's not coherent. And what we want to show is that Old Testament narrative, defined in its own terms, is one story, and that by reference to the one story, we can then put every particular narrative we read into its proper context. So it's a very important interpretive step that we begin with here tonight. So my purpose is both to show what that narrative is, and just as importantly, to show how we got there. Because I want you to not just say, oh, isn't that interesting, but I want you to know how to think inductively about the text. Does that make sense? You with me? Okay. What is Old Testament narrative? I want us to think of it from three perspectives: historically, prophetically, and from the literary perspective. So first, the Old Testament narrative as history. I think it's important just to say that in the popular mind, certainly, the Old Testament is a bunch of myths, of nationalistic myths, of stories that were made up and evolved over a period of time and probably have no bearing whatsoever to actual events. And that's certainly the perspective that you'd get at the secular university, the History Channel, any of the mainstream ways of getting knowledge about the Bible are going to come basically from this perspective, which is essentially the 19th century perspective. It's the idea that religious ideas, just like biology, goes through an evolutionary process from simple to complex. And that the Bible then would reflect the same sort of evolutionary process from simple concepts of God to advanced ones, multiple sources reflecting this kind of thing. And this is not a course in theology or criticism, so I don't want to explore that in any detail, but I do feel the need to say some things about the Bible's own assumptions about itself. That the Bible, at least, regards itself to be historical, that the narratives are not just myths or stories, but they're actual events that are being chronicled by the narrator. And there are three reasons for this. One is because when we look at how narrative texts of Scripture are interpreted by other biblical authors, again, this whole intertextual commentary idea, they are assumed to be historically factual. They're assumed to be events that actually occurred. And so for that reason, we want to take the Bible in its own terms. And when it purports to be historical, we take it to be historical. Second, the whole assumption that the Bible is basically myth until it can be proven otherwise by archaeology or whatever is really a flawed assumption and really new to modern scholarship as well. And, it's pretty interesting. In the early 1900s, the German especially, but also American scholars, historians, were confidently proclaiming that people like Abraham were just mythological people. They never existed. That the story of Sodom and Gomorrah is impossible because there was never such a place as Sodom or Gomorrah until it was discovered archaeologically. Till references to the city of Sodom were discovered in northern Syria, datable to the time of Abraham, that used on trade tablets the name Abraham. Probably not the biblical Abraham, but it shows that the name was at least a part of that time. So what happened was that critical scholars then said, well, okay, we'll accept some of this as probably historical. But it's only, again, based upon what we can prove through archaeology. And what we're saying here is basically, why would we do that? If the text purports to be historical, and everything that we know about what it references in history is true, then why not accept it on its own terms as historical? Of course we should do that to be consistent. But most importantly, for the sake of our purposes, is the third point, which is that the literary style of Old Testament narrative is definitely set in significant contrast to the epic style or the mythological style of Mesopotamian or ancient Near Eastern religious writing. And so there are important books like Alexander Heidel's Babylonian Genesis or James Pritchard's Ancient Near East Texts, books like that are really good at showing just, okay, here's the Enuma Elish, the Babylonian creation myth. Here's the Old Testament. Here's the Genesis creation account. Here's the flood story of Gilgamesh, and here is Genesis 6 through 9. And just showing those comparisons, very important because it highlights the radical differences that exist between the narrative accounts of the Bible and the mythological form of communication that was a part of the mythology of the ancient Near East. And really, just citing the Israeli scholar Talman, Robert Altier makes this point in The Art of Biblical Narrative, which I think is just hits the nail right on the head. He says, the ancient Hebrew writers purposely nurtured and developed prose narration to take the place of the epic genre, which by its content was intimately bound up with the world of paganism and appears to have had a special standing in polytheistic cults. Recitation of the epics was tantamount to an enactment of cosmic events in the manner of sympathetic magic. In the process of the total rejection of the polytheistic religions and their ritual expressions in the cult, epic songs and also the epic genre were purged from the repertoire of the Hebrew authors. And I think that's just very well said. In the mythological accounts of creation and flood and so forth, you have completely unhistorical and implausible accounts of gods battling with gods, slicing the body of a defeated god to create the cosmos, genealogies of the gods, who were their fathers and fathers' fathers and so forth, and it's clearly mythological. And what scholars like Alexander Heidel at the University of Chicago, Talman and at the University of Jerusalem, others have pointed out, I think, effectively, is that all of the fantastical dimensions of mythology simply don't exist in biblical narrative. That it is very intentionally seeking not to be understood as mythology, but rather as history. Okay? So we will accept it on those terms. Also, in terms of the Bible as history, not only is it not mythological, it actually is apologetic against the mythological frameworks that existed among Israel's neighbors. A key purpose of Old Testament narrative is to contrast the actually existing God of Israel, a God capable of actually acting in history, with the non-existent animistic deities worshipped in the ancient Near East. And, you know, just an easy example of that would be 1 Kings 18, right? The competition between Elijah and the prophets of Baal, where it's just Elijah's simple prayer is set in opposition to the slashing and cutting and incantations and all that of the prophets of Baal. G. Ernest Wright, in his Old Testament Against Its Environment, which is a short series of lectures. It's a beautiful book. It's about 60 years old now and is just as fresh as it was when he originally wrote it. But Wright says this. He says, biblical faith is a challenge to commitment. And even the historical literature as we have it was edited, preserved, and for the most part originally written with this definite evangelical purpose. Decide on the evidence and act accordingly. What is the evidence? It is the evidence of history. What God has the power to do what he wills and to fulfill his promises. Virtually the only comparative religion which the Old Testament possesses is of this type. Okay. It is God who can uniquely act in history. And that's why Israel is summoned to be God's witnesses. If you just take a concordance out and you key in witness or witnesses, and you see numerous references to God calling on Israel, you experienced my sovereignty in history. You wrote this history down. You're my witnesses. And over 200 times then in the Old Testament, Israel is summoned to remember. That's one of the most important verbs in the Old Testament, to remember. Remember what? Remember what God has done in history through liberating you from the house of slavery, from creating the universe, all of these things that God has done in history to set himself off against the mythological fantasies of the Canaanite, the Mesopotamian, the Egyptian, and so forth. And then lastly, in terms of these narratives as history, is the important idea of linear time that is unique, that is absolutely fundamentally unique to the pages of the Scriptures. The Bible stands in startling contrast to the ancient conceptions of time. And following the cycles of nature, right? Winter, spring, summer, fall, which leads to what? Winter, spring, summer, fall, which leads to winter, spring, summer, fall. We're caught in a circle. And that is the ancient worldview. The cycle of nature is for the Mesopotamian, the Egyptian, the Greek, the African, the Mayan, the Chinese. All of the writings of antiquity outside the Bible describe history as a wheel or as a circle. Time leads to nothing. It just repeats the endless turning from season to season, life to death. But in the biblical view, history progresses through a meaningful and coherent drama toward an end. In the biblical description, it begins in the beginning. There is a meaningful sequence of events followed by an eschaton, an end. And that's fundamentally distinct from all philosophical reflection, from all religious outlook in the ancient world. Universally, it is this way. And again, citing Wright, he says, creation and election, promise and fulfillment were the means by which history was interpreted. Thus, it came about that the biblical sense of history was born. The contemporary polytheisms, having analyzed the problem of life over and against nature, had little sense or concern with the significance of history. Nature, with its ever-changing seasons, was cyclical, and human life, constantly integrating itself with nature by means of cultic activity and sympathetic magic, moved with nature in a cyclical manner. But Yahweh was the God of history, the living God, unaffected by the cycles of nature, who set himself to accomplish a definite purpose in time. Both beginning and end, creation and eschatology, therefore became an integral part of the Israelite view of time. Our ability to speak in terms of progress, our ability to speak in terms of meaning, all emerge out of the idea that history is going someplace and is superintended by a sovereign God whose purposes is history serves. And how different this is from the cyclical view of time that we're not going anywhere. There is no future that's distinct from the past. It's all just the cycle of life and death, the circle of life. Like, you know, the Disney movie, whatever that thing's called. Thank you, The Lion King. I'm a little out of touch. What does that mean? It just means that it's all meaningless. That's what it means. That we're all just a part of this machinery that's going nowhere and serves no purpose whatsoever. And the Bible categorically, uniquely stands in opposition to that worldview to say that no, history is moving to an end. History is moving in a direction. It is superintended by a sovereign God to serve his ends, which are good and right and serve the interests of humans created in his image. The popular historian Thomas Cahill, who's written so many excellent books like How the Irish Saved Civilization, a number of books like that, also wrote a book on the Old Testament called The Gifts of the Jews. And I think he makes an important point here, commenting on Genesis 12, verse 1, where God calls on Abraham to go forth from his country to the land that I will show you, he says. And Cahill comments, he says, on every continent, in every society, Abraham would have been given the same advice that wise men as diverse as the Greeks, Heraclitus, the Chinese, Lao Tzu, the Buddha, Siddhartha, would one day give his followers. Do not journey, but sit. Compose yourself by the river. Meditate on its ceaseless and meaningless flow, on all that is past or passing or to come, until you have absorbed the pattern and have come to peace with the great wheel, with your own death, and with the death of all things in the corruptible sphere. This is nihilism. Cahill's point is the right point. He says, if history's not going anywhere, there's no meaning to your life either. And the only base to think about meaning in life is if life is moving toward an end that matters, to a culmination, to a resolution of the story. And that is the nature of biblical history, linear time. Now let's talk secondly about Old Testament narrative as theology. This is a fairly important point, I believe, that historical narratives of the Old Testament were written by prophets to demonstrate the faithfulness of God to his promises in and sovereignty over human history. I want to just demonstrate this fact from the Old Testament book of 2 Chronicles, chapter 32. And since you have your Bibles with you, you can flip there with me. Second Chronicles is the historical narrative of Israel under the rule of kings. And in 2 Chronicles 32, verse 32, the chronicler says this. He says, now the rest of the acts of Hezekiah, that's a king in Judah, and his deeds of devotion, behold, they are written in the vision of Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amos, in the book of Kings of Judah and Israel. Now, this is a very important little reference because it's coming out of the historical narratives of the Old Testament, and it is ascribing specific authorial authorship of a prophet to the book of Kings, book of 1 and 2 Kings. Namely, it's saying that Isaiah the prophet is the one who wrote the book of 1 and 2 Kings. And indeed, when you look at the book of Kings and you read the story of Hezekiah as it's recorded in 1 Kings or 2 Kings 18 to 20, you see that it's almost word for word the same thing as Isaiah chapters 36 through 39. So what I'm trying to suggest to you is when we say that Old Testament narratives are prophetic, What I mean is they are written by prophets to serve a specific theological purpose, a purpose about the nature of God and his plan in the world. So that, I think that's really crucial that we see that it's not just an assumption that we can derive prophetic insight or knowledge about God from these chronicles. They're not just disinterested historians kind of writing a history like a modern historian would do. These are prophets receiving revelation from God about the significance of the very acts that they are recording in their books. You see what I'm saying? So, what are these historical narratives? These historical narratives are pieces of prophecy. It is God speaking about the very purposes he has brought into history. I love what Isaiah describes this in Isaiah chapter 46, verses 9 to 11. He says, "Remember the former things long past." That's again that important verb, to remember. Remember what God has done. He says, "For I am God, there is no other. I am God, and there's no one like me, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times, things which have not been done, saying, my purpose will be established, and I will accomplish my good pleasure, calling a bird of prey from the east and the man of my purpose from a far country. Truly I have spoken, truly I will bring it to pass, I have planned it. Surely I will do it." What is Isaiah saying? History is not just a sequence of events. It is God accomplishing his very purpose and his intent for humanity in it. And for this reason, then, as we read Old Testament narratives, we recognize them as interrelated, progressive accounts of what God's purpose for history is and how he intends to accomplish it. We need to look at them in two tiers. First, from the historical. The context of God's revelation is history. But also, from the prophetic point of view, that there is a purpose for history. History serves God's ends. It is the unfolding, as Isaiah says, of his plan. This is not a meaningless cycle, not a meaningless wheel of existence. It is a linear plan that God has breathed into human history to accomplish his purposes. And that's why these historical writings are also prophetic writings, because they lay out what is this purpose God has for humanity. And let's talk about then, thirdly, and at some length, from the perspective of literature. And the narratives of the Old Testament, of course, are literature. The first principle that I want us to think about here, and just briefly because we're going to come back to it next week, is that theological narrative or historical narrative or biblical narrative is selective and purposeful. The idea here being that events and people are anchored in Israel's history and are to be understood in relation to the main or implied theological point of the narrative. And so, in other words, like any historian, like any writer, biblical writers are selective in how they tell a story and who they include and how they put them in the story. And so we will take a close look at how these narratives are arranged, how they are written, because the point of view of the author as they introduce characters, as they give exaggerated space to some characters and minimal space to others, what they leave out, what they include, these are all going to be very important cues to the meaning, the literary meaning, as it was intended by the author. But the point that we really are going to just discuss for the rest of our time here this evening is this second principle, that the main point of any particular narrative that we study is based on its relationship to the broader structure of the whole of the Old Testament narrative story. In other words, we have to understand the particular act of the play in the context of the whole story, and there are implications to this assumption. And the key implication is that interpreters, like ourselves, must inductively identify the theological framework or structure of Old Testament narrative. In other words, we have to say, we have to identify what that story is from the text itself. Not imposed on the text, but from the text itself. What is the thread, the storyline that holds all of these narratives together? How are we to know what the story is about? And here I want to introduce a term that we'll be using quite a bit, and we're just going to call it markers, literary markers, which are statements specifically given by God that disclose the purpose or the reason for the narrative. A marker is a statement of divine purpose. That's in essence what it is. And they come basically in three forms. First is words of blessing. So, for instance, in the early Genesis narrative, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Okay? So that gives a purpose or a reason for the creation of man. Right? Second are covenants. In the language of thou shalt, or I will. So the law of Moses is a marker, and that really guides or directs the trajectory of Old Testament narrative, or the new covenant of Jeremiah 31 in that narrative context. And most especially are the promises of God, the I will language of God, the unconditional statement of God's intent for his people. And I want to just demonstrate to you that by reference to two key promises that God makes, two key statements of purpose from the literary point of view, two key markers, we can really bring together the whole Old Testament story from the literary point of view. And the two key promises or theological markers we want to look at are Genesis 12, verses 1 to 3, and 2 Samuel 7, verses 8 to 17. Both of these, I suspect, or at least one of them, is fairly familiar to you. But let's go ahead and take a look. It's short. Genesis 12, 1 to 3. Here it says, now the Lord said to Abram, go forth from your country, from your relatives, from your house of the father, to the land that I will show you, and I will make you a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you, and those who curse you I will curse, and in you all the families of the world will be blessed. I will, he says. I will do these things. These are words of promise. These are things that God says he will do. Not once does it say if. Not once does it say, and thou shalt. It just is a promise of God. And it operates in three ways. The particular promises to Abraham, right? What does it say about Abraham? What will I do? I'll make you great. I'll bless you. And beyond Abraham, he says, and I will make of you a great nation, right? So there's a promise of nationhood there. And then finally, as well, there is a purpose statement for his blessing on Abraham and the gift of nationhood, and which is what? To bless the whole earth. So God's statement of purpose and his promise to Abraham is universal to all the families of the earth, but they are also particular to Abraham and to the nation that God would birth out from him. So that's promise number one. Promise number two is 2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 8 to 17. This is the story of David when he becomes king, and Saul and his family have been taken out of the political equation. And David makes Jerusalem, the capital of the nation, and he has the intent to build a temple for God. It says in 2 Samuel 7, as soon as I find my way there, he says, verse 8, "Now therefore, thus you shall say to my servant David," this is God speaking to the prophet Nathan, "thus says the Lord of hosts, I took you from the pasture, from following the sheep, to be a ruler over my people. I have been with you wherever you have gone and have cut off all your enemies from before you, and I will make you a great name like the names of the great men who are on the earth." So there's a promise to David, right? And then he says, "I will appoint a place for my people Israel, and I will plant them, and they will live in their place and will not be disturbed again, nor will the wicked afflict them as in former times, even from the day that I have commanded judges to be over my people Israel, and I will give you rest from all your enemies, David. The Lord also declares to you that the Lord will make a house for you." And now, house not as a physical structure, but house as a dynasty. "When your days are complete and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your descendant after you who will come forth from you, and I will establish his kingdom." That's Solomon and the line of Solomon that comes after him. "And he shall build a house for my name," namely the temple, "and I will establish his throne forever." Wow. "And I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me. When he commits iniquity, I will correct him with the rod of men and the strokes of the sons of men." Okay, when these kings that come from your line are disobedient, I'll discipline them. "But my loving kindness shall never depart from him, as I took it away from Saul, who I removed from being king before you. Your house and your kingdom shall endure before me forever. Your throne shall be established forever." And in accordance with all these words and with all this vision, Nathan spoke to David. So here's the Davidic promise. Promises to David as a man to be blessed, have rest from his enemies. The promise of a dynasty that would come forth from him, a succession of kings from his line. And then the ultimate extent of it, just as the promise to Abraham was to all the families of the earth, the promise of David is throughout all time, an eternal kingdom. And so, my friends, what we're saying is that by reference to these two key promises God makes, the whole Old Testament narrative fits together. Consciously in reference to these, the God's fulfillment of these two covenants in history. Let's just show how this works. First, the Abrahamic promise is without any doubt the literary center of the books of Genesis through Joshua, the first six books of the Old Testament. And so in Genesis 12, through 50, the end, we see God's faithfulness to his blessing on Abraham. I'm not going to talk too much about it because that's going to be your homework assignment to demonstrate that this is true. Then secondly, we find that God does in fact not only bless Abraham the man in the Abraham narrative and his generations to follow, but that he also emerges from that line, from that family, a nation. And forms a people. That's what the book of Exodus is all about. The people are liberated from their captivity. They're redeemed. They're given a law that binds them together, much like a constitution, and binds them to their God. They're a distinct ethnicity by virtue of circumcision and birth in the Abraham line. And then in the book of Joshua, they inherit the land. So all the conditions for nationhood are established. A land, a people, and a constitution that binds them together. So all of the first six books of the Old Testament then really fit within the framework of God fulfilling this great promise that he makes to Abraham. And then with respect to the rest of the narrative history of the Old Testament, the Davidic covenant provides also the literary center of the book of Judges through the book of 2 Chronicles. The book of Judges, Ruth, 1 Samuel are preparations for the monarchy, as we'll demonstrate here in just a minute. They are looking forward to, they're consciously anticipating the coming of monarchy in Israel. 2 Kings chapter 7 through 24 and the book of 1 Chronicles through chapter 29 show God's blessing on the house of David, God's faithfulness to that promise. In 1 Kings chapter 1 through 11, we have God's faithfulness to Solomon, his son, that would accede to the throne after him. And in the remaining history of the Old Testament narrative, God's faithfulness remains to the Davidic line. And so that encompasses all of the historical narrative of the Old Testament. We're going to say more about that for a minute. I just wanted to give you the broad strokes. This principle, here are two promises. By reference to these two promises, in a very conscious way, we can reconcile all of the historical narrative in the Old Testament. Now, just if we wanted to be more specific and more precise, and we're not going to talk about this much right now, on the next page of your outline, I've just basically described the seven kind of historical movements in Old Testament narrative history. And specifically, and how it encompasses all the books of the Old Testament, the right-hand column are key statements of theological purpose, and the one that right beside that, historical events, show how God moves in history to honor these key theological statements that he has made. And it's just an unmistakable connection between what God says he's going to do and how the narrative history of the Old Testament works out. Okay, how do we know, okay, I've laid out the thought conceptually that the whole of the big picture, the big story of Old Testament narrative comes in reference to these two great promises of God. The question then specifically is, how do we prove that? How do we know from the text that that's really true? And that brings us then to a consideration of what we're calling in your outline here, links. Links. Connectors between texts that identify the relationship of one historical narrative to another, that connect the present with the past and with the future. See that in your outline? Okay. Links are found at crucial transitions throughout biblical narrative, and they explain how the present narrative relates to the broader narrative of the Old Testament. In other words, there will be multiple references in the book, in the narrative of the Old Testament, to the promise of God to Abraham. Dozens of them. And what that shows is the very conscious connection in the author of these narratives' minds of the history that they are writing in their present day to the past promise that God has made to Abraham. See what I'm saying? That's a link. And it's what shows us how the whole story fits together. It is how each narrative is like a link in the chain that is the Old Testament story. Hence the term links. And so awareness of these links is central to demonstrating in an inductive way the theological and literary unity of the Scriptures. And so let me just describe to you how does this work. Links unite each of the historical periods of the Old Testament in the following way. So the pre-patriarchal narratives are Genesis 1 through chapter 11. That's pre-history. That sets the stage for Abraham. And then the patriarchal narratives are Genesis 12 to Genesis 50, the story of Abraham and the generation following with Isaac, then with Jacob, and then with the 12 sons of Jacob. And so there is a key theological statement of purpose in creation, which is to be fruitful and multiply. That's Genesis chapter 2. The purpose of God in creating man is that he would enjoy the world that God has made, that he would be fruitful, that he would multiply and fill the earth. And this statement of God's blessing and God's purpose is repeated again in Genesis 8 after the flood, 9 after the during the flood, after the flood, chapter 17, right at the heart of the patriarchal story, and in chapter 26. And so what it's saying is that God's original purpose for creation, to be fruitful and multiply, has continued even though humanity has come into this fallen state. Even though man is in rebellion against God, God's purposes for man has not changed. It's still his purpose that man be fruitful and multiply and live under the blessing of God. A second significant link is the promise of seed that comes in the curse narrative of Genesis 3, verse 15. You know the story that Adam and Eve fall, the woman is cursed, that the man is cursed, and also that the perpetrator of rebellion is cursed. The serpent is cursed. How? Through the seed that would come. The descendant that would come and would destroy the adversary. The serpent will bite you on the heel. It's not a mortal wound. And you will crush his head, God says, of this figure, this descendant, this seed that is to come. And we find that after the fall, that this becomes a central concern, actually, of the writing of Genesis. And so in the Noah narrative, which follows in Genesis chapter 5, verse 29, when Noah is introduced and he's born, Lamech, his father, names him. He says in verse 29, he will be called Noah, saying, "This one will give us rest from our work and from the toil of our hands arising from the ground which the Lord has cursed." In other words, Noah was viewed by his father Lamech as, in some way, the fulfillment of this messianic figure, this seed that would come to destroy the perpetrator of human rebellion against God. And that whole concept of seed, then, descendant, that will have this key purpose of God now in the world of dealing with God's own adversary, the devil, manifests itself ultimately in the selection of one of three families of Noah, namely Shem. That's Genesis 9, verse 27. And then the ultimate Shemite, Genesis chapter 12, which is Abraham. The word Semite comes from Shem. And it is through Abraham, the son of Shem, the son of Noah, you know, with lots of generations in between, that this hope, of the seed that would come and deal decisively with the cause of man's anguish and alienation from God is being fulfilled. And of course that story of the seed is going to go way beyond the narrative sections of the Old Testament, as we'll see when we get to the prophets and to the New Testament. But nonetheless, it is there. So that is one way in which these linking things operate. Secondly, we think about the patriarchal story, Genesis 12 to 50, in relation to the story in Exodus, the Egyptian captivity and the release from bondage there. We find in Exodus 20, chapter 2, verses 23 to 25, that God sees the condition of his people now enslaved in Egypt. And what does he do? It says that he remembered. He remembered his promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he saw their suffering. And so that's a linking passage. You see that? He's taking the promise that God made to Abraham and repeat it again in every generation after Abraham. And he's saying, here are my people, and I have not forgotten that promise that I made. And so that sets up what Exodus is all about, which is God honoring his promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob to give them the gift of nationhood. It's a very explicit connection in the text. There is also very explicit connection between the Exodus narrative of redemption, of release from bondage and slavery in Egypt to the conquest narrative in the book of Joshua. And so, just as God used Moses as the human agent through whom captive Israel finds its release from their bondage, also we're told that Joshua has the same sort of role, and that God would be with Joshua just as it says, I will be with Moses. I was with Moses. That's Joshua 1, verse 5, Joshua 3, verse 7. There are other references as well, but it's really clear in the language that the story of the Exodus continues in that next generation, and that God, the same God who was involved with the liberator, with Moses, continues to be involved in the work that is not yet complete, namely in the successor of Moses, which is Joshua. And indeed, even the events that surrounded the Exodus are repeated again in the book of Joshua. So just as God parted the Red Seas, God parts the Jordan River. Just as Moses circumcises that generation, so Joshua circumcises that generation. Just as Moses celebrates the first Passover, so as they enter into the land, Joshua also celebrates the Passover. Just as Moses received the law from God, so Joshua also copies the law of God. And those event repetitions are very important, because what they're saying is that the purpose of God in redemption from Israel continues through the new Moses, who is Joshua, in the conquest narrative. You follow? Okay. Now, there is linkage then as well that within the text that we can identify between Joshua and the book of Judges, which is the next historical book, and into the united monarchy, which is 2 Samuel through the end, really, of the historical narratives. That Judges is an era that's plagued with a problem. And the repeated line in Judges 21 and another reference as well is that there was no king in the land, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. That's the way that the historian summarizes the problem in this window of time where Israel is ruled by judges, saying there's just no king in the land. That's our problem. Then we move to the book of Ruth, the next book after the book of Judges. And Ruth's genealogy at the end in Ruth chapter 4 ends with reference to King David. That Ruth is the great-grandmother of David the king. That the prophetic words of Hannah, the mother of Samuel, in 1 Samuel 2, before God promises to bring up a king, is that her son would be the one who anoints God's king. And so all of these narratives are very consciously looking forward to Israel being ruled by the king. And there are important links as well in Judges to the law of Moses in the book of Deuteronomy and Exodus as well. So all of these things they're citing works, they're tying previous works together in this chain that shows a continuity of the story throughout. And then finally, in the narratives of the united monarchy, which is David and Solomon, and the divided monarchy, which is when Israel divides into two nations, and there is a divided monarchy, still God's intent to honor his promise to David is explicitly made in 1 Kings 11 and then also connecting with past revelation in 1 Kings 9 in relation to the law. And so these are snapshots, I realize, and I'm moving quickly, but what I'm trying to show you is that there is an internal structure to these narratives. They're not to be viewed in isolation. They were written with this important overlap in mind. That they are using language from previous narratives, promises from previous narratives, and they're writing them in such a way that there is this total literary continuity. It is one story, and no story can be viewed in isolation, and every story is necessary to complete the picture of what God is doing to fulfill his promises to Abraham and to David. That, I grant you, is a mouthful. So, you okay? No. But you'll see this. We're going to get into these narratives, and what may seem Like a lot of information now will become increasingly clear as we begin to examine some of these stories. I want to make a final point about the Old Testament and the flow of history. And we've made this point that none of these narratives can be viewed in isolation. All of them are consciously tied to the language and the promises of the other narratives, so that it's all one story. But there is also this kind of interesting view of history that the narratives include and that are really inherent in the whole of the Old Testament. And the idea here and the principle is that Old Testament narratives, historical in his Old Testament narratives, the historical past is incomplete and is being filled and ultimately fulfilled or filled to its fullest in subsequent revelation. And what do I mean by that? What I mean by that is that key elements in history become a pattern for how God works, a thematic paradigm, a motif. And it is repeated in various ways in later narratives and in prophecy as well that anticipate the culmination of history defined in the terms of these great epic narratives of the Old Testament. So the theology of a particular event, a historical narrative, becomes sort of a paradigm or a model, a picture, as it were, of how salvation operates. A historical narrative establishes itself as a paradigm for how salvation operates. And let me give some examples of this. One of the important motifs in the Old Testament is how God miraculously works. When God promises, it's God who delivers. It is out of the impossibility of human fulfillment that God manifests his unique sovereignty over history. So, for instance, God promised Abraham a son. But Abraham, as it turns out, had a problem. And the problem was, he was old and his wife was barren. Okay? And so the whole narrative there, especially in Genesis 14 and 15, and really up into 17, is about the fact that what man can't do, God can. And out of the barrenness of Sarah's womb comes the child of promise, Isaac, right? Amazing. And it just demonstrates, again, the remarkable power of God to do what no man can, to fulfill his promises. But you know what? Isaac seemed to have a problem as well. What was Isaac's problem? He was married to this woman named Rebecca. And Rebecca had, you guessed it, an empty womb. She also was barren. And so what does it mean? Well, if she's going to contribute to God's fulfillment of this promise of nationhood through Abraham, something's got to give. And what gives is that God brings fruitfulness to her womb. And she has a son. She has a couple sons, in fact. Right? And so Jacob, who becomes the next generation in the line of God's promises, marries Rachel. And guess what Rachel has? She's got a problem. She's barren. And miraculously, in her barrenness, God produces a child whose name is Joseph. And so you see God acting in this uniform, this consistent way that out of the barrenness of the mother's womb, God brings forth the hero, the one who is going to keep God's promise alive. And so you see that same kind of motif then. That becomes like a literary theme now. We can expect it. So when we come to 1 Samuel and we read about Hannah, and Hannah is, you guessed it, barren, and she pleads with God for a son, and God miraculously grants her that prayer, and she has the son. What would you think about that son? He must be a pretty special guy. He must be the person of God's choosing to accomplish his purpose. And sure enough, Samuel was just exactly that man. He's the bridge into the monarchy. He's the one who anoints David as king. Well, then a few years later, there's this other woman, pious woman, and she was barren also. And she cries out to God, and God answers her prayer, and this kid by the name of John is born. And her cousin, younger cousin, Mary, is also childless, and by the most impossible of means, the hero of heroes is born in the Immaculate Conception of Christ. I'm telling you, this is how motifs operate, and there are several of them that show that God's pattern of working in history grows until it reaches the culmination, the fulfillment of his purposes in history. Are you following me? We'll give some more examples. The central narratives of the Old Testament really disclose the whole point of God in the scriptures. Creation, the forming of a nation, and the exodus from bondage in Egypt. Those three narratives become central and foundational to the whole biblical story. And they address three specific dimensions of salvation, of the purpose of God in human history. The first is regeneration, bringing life out of death. It begins from the very beginning in the creation narrative. The statement is that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and then there's a circumstantial clause. What was the earth like when God did what he did? It was formless and void, tohu wabohu, chaotic and lifeless. Then God did something. What did God do? God said. God said it was, and it was good, and God brought life out of death. And God is the God of regeneration, and the whole idea of God bringing life out of death becomes really a paradigm for how God works. We'll see this when we get to the prophets especially, because they really key in on the creation as a picture of salvation. But we see it also when we come to the pages of the New Testament, as Jesus talks to Nicodemus in John chapter 3. Here is an expert in the law, but he misses something very important, which is what? You must be regenerated. You must be born again. The whole concept of the Christian life being new life, being regenerated, is the fulfillment of God's intent for history. Reconciliation. In the fall, man is alienated from man. Man is alienated from God. But in the work through these historic narratives, God forms a people to reconcile his renegade creation, forms a man, forms a nation, forms a people of his own choosing. And then thirdly, in the historical narrative of the Exodus, we have the picture of redemption, that the human condition is that we are in bondage, we are in sin, we are in over our heads, we cannot buy our way out. God must act. And how does God act? God acts through the substitutionary sacrifice of an animal. who is a paradigm of the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. And how does the story end? Just take a look at Revelation chapter 19. See these dimensions of salvation that begin in the narrative context of the Old Testament come to their fulfillment in heaven. In Revelation 19, verses 7 and 8, this is the marriage feast of the Lamb. Look at this. He says, "Let us rejoice and be glad and give the glory to Him, for the marriage of the Lamb has come and His bride has made herself ready. It was given to her to clothe herself in fine linen, bright and clean, for the fine linen is the righteous acts of the saints." It's very interesting in this description of the reconciliation of history. That there are these three dimensions there. There is the bride who stands forever in the presence of God, reconciled to God as His bride. That's how intimate and how complete the reconciliation is. Wearing what kind of garment? White linen, clean, so that all stain of sin has been taken out of the way. So that the regenerated bride of Christ can live forever in relation to the Lamb without any spot or wrinkle or any such thing. Those three dimensions. That is the story of salvation. And it begins in the narrative context, really in the book of Genesis from the very beginning. And the whole story of Scripture is simply how we go from the catastrophe of the fall to the incredible celebration of the marriage feast of the Lamb. It is history reaching its fullness, because history is the plan of God. See what I'm saying? Okay, let's take it just a little bit deeper, and then we'll end, and I'll give you your assignment. In the case of the paradigm of redemption, the paradigm of Exodus being a motif, an event of history that grows and reaches its fullness, it's very evident that, for instance, okay, so you have the Exodus of God's people from their captivity to the Egyptians through the plagues, the final plague being the Passover, the death of the lamb on behalf of the firstborn who's sentenced to die. You have the parting of the Red Sea, the provision of light through the column of smoke and fire, the provision of manna and water from the rock, and this remarkable, miraculous deliverance from God. But the authors of the narrative of the Old Testament don't want us to think that the story ends there, that redemption began with the Exodus. It wasn't completed with the Exodus. And so, as we were saying a minute ago, in the narrative of Joshua, all of the key elements of the Exodus narrative of redemption are repeated again in Joshua's ministry. And then, as the prophets, hundreds of years later, then are looking at their own bondage to the house of Babylon in the Babylonian captivity, God again begins to speak to them of an ongoing work of redemption. And how does He define redemption? Well, He defines it in terms of a historic past, in terms of the exodus of God's people from Egypt. And so, for instance, it says in Hosea 11, verse 1, "Out of Egypt did I call my son." Well, Hosea is writing in the context of the Babylonian captivity. And he's saying that just as God was faithful to deliver the children of Israel under the Pharaoh, He will be faithful to deliver us from Babylon's reign as well. The same is true in Isaiah chapter 11, a new exodus A new Exodus, Isaiah says, is to occur. God's not done with his Exodus work. More Exodus is to come as God will release you from your bondage to foreign powers. And then Isaiah, in an unbelievable gaze into the future, which you just have got to read. This is Isaiah chapter 19. Isaiah then begins to think about the end of human history, the end of God's program on the earth. And notice how he describes it. This is Isaiah 19, and starting in verse 19, where he says, "In that day, the day of the Lord, the culmination of history, in that day, there will be an altar of the Lord in the midst of the land of Egypt, and a pillar to the Lord near its border. And it will be a sign and a witness to the Lord of hosts in the land of Egypt. For they will cry out to the Lord because of oppressors." If you're familiar with the narrative of Exodus, this is exactly language taken of Moses as he's describing the condition of Israel oppressed in the land of Egypt. But now it's being applied to Egypt, that they will cry out because of oppressors, and God will send them a savior and a champion, and he will deliver them. Thus, the Lord will make himself known to Egypt, and the Egyptians will know the Lord in that day. And they will even worship and with sacrifice and offering, and will make a vow to the Lord and perform it. And the Lord will strike Egypt, striking but healing, so they will return to the Lord, and he will respond to them and heal them. And in that day, there will be a highway from Egypt to Assyria. Not a highway in the wilderness, as Moses describes, but a highway between the two greatest enemies of Israel. Egypt, the place of the captivity, and Assyria, who in 722 BC destroys the 10 northern tribes of Israel. And using the Exodus language, Isaiah says that there will be a highway of the Lord between these two enemies. And the Assyrians will come into Egypt and the Egyptians into Assyria, and the Egyptians will worship with the Assyrians. And in that day, Israel will be third party with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing in the midst of the earth, whom the Lord of hosts has blessed, saying, get this, blessed is Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, my inheritance. And Isaiah is casting his eyes to the end of human history and says that the Exodus will be complete when even Israel's neighbors will experience the redemption of God. And the language of the Exodus is unmistakable in this text. He says, Egypt, my people. Well, that's the same language that God uses of Israel in Exodus. Israel is my son, my people, my inheritance. And yet God is saying, no, beyond that, even your enemies will enjoy the redemptive hand of God. They too will have an Exodus. That's an amazing picture of the fullness of what does redemption mean? What is the Exodus story even about? The Jewish scholar Michael Fishbane has written an important book called Text and Texture, where he really, I think, in an amazing way captures the depth of some of these motifs that we've been describing. And in relation to the Exodus motif, he makes this point about Isaiah chapter 19. He says, such a transfer of designation used pointedly of Israel in Exodus 3:10 weighed heavily on ancient Jewish translators. Now get this. Unable to tolerate such theological paradox, the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, and the Targum traditions, which are the Aramaic translations of the Old Testament, nationalized the text and substituted Israel for Egypt. Do you see what he's saying? He's saying that Israelite scribes were so scandalized by the grace of God that they could not tolerate the thought that God would have a redemption for Israel's enemies just as he had for them. And so they got out their eraser and they took reference to Egypt and Assyria out of Isaiah and substituted in Israel. Remarkable. But that's God. See. So what we're saying is that these theological narratives are consciously interconnected with common language and common literary motifs, and that together they create a picture that grows over time until it reaches its fullness and indeed its fulfillment at the end of God's program for history. And in this way, then, the theological, historical narratives of the Old Testament really provide the language and the key concepts for all of biblical theology.